You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 29th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Chloe Maxman, Maine State Senator and political strategist Canyon Woodward, authors of Dirt Road Revival, how to rebuild rural politics and why our future depends on it. And later in the show, Ruth Ben-Ghia, professor of history and Italian studies at NYU, will join us to discuss the rise of the far right in Italy. Meanwhile, Hurricane Ian has now hit Florida, knocking out power for at least 2.5 million people, cutting off bridge access to aisles and more. Florida officials think the death toll will be in the hundreds, and 20 Cuban migrants who were on a boat are already missing and feared dead. Schumer has formally filed cloture on a continuing resolution to keep the government funded through mid-December, sans the Manchin permitting rider. A vote is expected tomorrow, barring any maneuverings by Mitch McConnell. Biden has finally granted a Jones Act waiver for Puerto Rico, or the White House, rather. So non-U.S. flagships with fuel and supplies can arrive on the island. This is a relic of colonialism, and frankly, it's an extension of colonial control. Inexcusable to not have been proactive on that. New polling in Senate races. Fox News has Warnock leading Herschel Walker by 5 points and Fetterman leading Oz by 4. A Marist poll also has Mark Kelly leading Blake Masters by 10. Wowza. And Daddy Peter Thiel doesn't seem to be coming to the rescue. Bootstraps, Blake. Republican candidate J.R. Majewski seems to have been caught in yet another lie. His lies, I mean Patriots' lies, are abundant. Majewski says Patriots was punished for a brawl while in the Air Force, but records indicate it was for a DUI. The Department of Defense's Inspector General has written a letter to Congress expressing concern over more deleted text messages from January 6th, this time from the DOD. So that makes the Secret Service, the DHS, and the DOD deleting text messages coincidentally all at that same time. Gavin Newsom has thankfully caved to farm workers in California after indicating he might veto a bill that allows farm workers to have the statutory right to form a union via card check, making unionization much easier and insulating them from harassment by their employer. Putin is holding a ceremony tomorrow in an effort to formally annex 4 areas of Ukraine after elections that many suspect were shams, dubious at best. This is as his military offensives are stalling. And lastly, Finland will close its borders to Russian tourists starting tomorrow, though the Russians coming over are often trying to flee conscription. Finland should be welcoming these asylum seekers, but they are not. And that's what they are. They're seeking asylum from having to participate in an unjust war. Let's be clear there. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I understand that, you know, Finland's a smaller country and we are looking at it from an outside perspective. I am Finnish myself. I have family over there still. But I am perplexed by some of the responses I've seen online to Finland doing so. There's like a general, I think, accepted xenophobia about Russian people in our discourse right now. And we have to remember that the Putin's actions are not the Russian people's actions. And there are plenty of Russian anti-war protesters who need solidarity. And there are plenty of Russian young men in this instance who do not want to fight in this war.
Yeah, it's
and
simply,
they should be getting our support.
It's simply war jingoism, where you would say, no, we're go back and, you know, fight Putin for us. Like that, you would never say that in these other conflicts that put that onus on regular people trying to escape conflict. So, yeah, it's gross.
Yeah, we're principled on this with Afghan refugees, with other asylum seekers coming from the southern border in this country. And when looking at this from an international perspective, I mean, we have to be consistent with Russian people trying to get out of the situation.
And I don't know the specifics as to like what's going on in the Baltic states or whatever, but I will just say that meme about slaps the hood and then you can fit so many of blank in this thing. Have you heard of that? America can fit a lot more of every sort of refugee, and we should be continue. I mean, when we were growing up as like children, we were taught that America was this sort of like shining beacon for anybody that was seeking refuge anywhere. Of course, the reality of that is a lot more dark, but we have the capability to, and we should be more accepting.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, Finland's population is something like, it might even be less than that of New York City. But still, doesn't matter. On principle, I believe that that's what should happen in those instances. But let's turn to Florida, because Hurricane Ian has made landfall in the southern part of Florida on the West Coast, and indications and of the storm's damage. You know, it's daytime now, so people are still trying to get people out of their homes. It's a little safer now, and rescue missions are happening, although of course still not safe if you're a regular person down there. But my point being is we still don't know the extent of the damage and the death toll, but local officials are essentially saying that it's going to be in the hundreds at the very least, because this storm was near Category 5. It's still considered a Category 4. And the experts that study this kind of stuff have said that this is the waters in the area around Florida have been unseasonably warm, which has increased the intensity of the storm. How many times do we have to say this? This is only going to happen more and more as the ramifications for climate change continue to be more acutely felt as the months and years go on, when we don't do anything substantial to combat this. You know, the storm surges were something like 18 feet above ground, 12 feet above ground, 16 feet, different reports are showing. And the areas that have been most affected thus far are Naples and I think Fort Worth is down there. And here's a clip of the Weather Channel's Jim Cantore in the middle of this storm. This is an aside because we're talking more generally about the storm's effects, but this practice of putting reporters in the middle of these dangerous conditions is just enough of this. This is not the way that employees should have to, you know, put pelts on the horse or whatever, or get their get these shots to advance their careers. This is sick. He's nearly killed here.
Even if they want to, they shouldn't be allowed to. You shouldn't be modeling this kind of behavior, because it trivializes the whole point you're trying to say about getting people out and into safety. We have drones now. Set up cameras that are like weather resistant that you can control remotely, and then you don't need a guy out there getting hit by a branch.
Oh, and I'm sorry, I said Fort Worth. I meant Fort Myers. Excuse me. But anyway, here's this clip of agreed on that. It sends the entirely wrong message. It's just there to get people visually engaged, and that's not worth it. But this just gives you a sense of how intense the storm is down there.
Styrofoam and things like that that are like underneath the roofing, maybe in the roof. It just came flying by. All right, you know what? I think I'm just going to come in here for a second.
Yeah. I mean,
the street sign
is flattened. Like...
Please do.
I mean, that branch there just sailed over his head. Like,
oh, is he all right?
No, he may not be all right.
I'm fine.
Well, he's trying to brace himself now.
Stand up.
You're going to get blown away.
All right.
I mean, that is not, to put it mildly, unsafe working conditions for the Weather Channel's team there, including the people behind the scenes. But you know, we're already hearing different people characterize this storm as once in 100 years, once in 1,000 years, as it's been over 100 hurricanes that have hit Florida, I think, since these things started to be documented in the 19th century. They're continuing to increase in intensity and going to harm more and more people. And there are a lot of people in Florida who are older. It's a state where many people retire, and they don't necessarily have the resources or ability to leave the state, and are also may have less mobility in terms of sheltering themselves, let alone the people who don't have the funds just generally to leave the state or to find shelter, or who may be losing wages because they work a gig job or they don't have guaranteed pay when they're not able to work. Like, the ramifications of this are not just, you know, storm damage. It also is going to kill people and harm people economically who have less at their disposal for quite a long period of time. These are the many different branches of how climate change is going to continue to make its effects felt. But here's Ron DeSantis, governor of the state, being a leader here, speaking about Hurricane Ian making landfall and making this same point that, I mean, could not be more childish, frankly.
Right now, if you look in Central Florida, you're looking at potential major flooding in Orange and Seminole counties, St. John's River, all the way up potentially into Northeast Florida and Jacksonville. The amount of water that's been rising and will likely continue to rise today, even as the storm is passing, is basically a 500-year flood event. And I know Seminole County has done evacuations. I know they've opened shelters, but we're going to see a lot of images about the destruction that was done in Southwest Florida, and obviously we have massive assets there. But people should just understand this storm is having broad impacts across the state, and some of the flooding you're going to see in areas hundreds of miles from where this made landfall are going to set records, and that's going to obviously be things that that will need to be responded to.
Oh, did he mention there the 500-year flood event? Yeah. Okay, good. I was making sure I didn't read it and imagine that he said it. But it's not a 500-year flood event. This has happened so many times just within my lifetime that these kinds of hurricanes have devastated Florida and, of course, Katrina, doing what it did
Ida,
in terms
Maria,
of harm to
Harvey.
Yeah. And I don't know if he reads the news about what happened in Puerto Rico just 2 weeks ago.
Fiona.
Yeah. The one-fifth of the island is still without power there, and they were unable to get fuel because ships had to be docked there because the Biden administration was slow to waive the Jones Act, so non-U.S. ships were able to get to Puerto Rico and give people power. But, I mean, you know, look, DeSantis is in his, you know, governor leadership mode there, so he's not going to say too much political. But I still think the characterization of these things as once every 500 years, as rare events, is malpractice because it does not, and I don't expect a Republican politician to do this, but you have to make a connection that, no, these are going to be once every year now, and probably more intense as the years go on because we've decided that greed and consumption is way more important than saving the planet.
Yeah, DeSantis also a climate denier. And the point is, like even if we, because I heard this too growing up in North Dakota, where the Red River would regularly flood like 3 out of the 5 years that I was an undergrad, and we missed significant time all those years because we had to sandbag. And every time it was like, oh, this is a 100-year flood, it's a 100-year flood. And it's like, well, maybe there's like a 100-year flood, but there's more than like 100 places, right? Or there's 500 places. So there's going to be a lot of, your chances, I guess, are going up. I'm playing this dumb mathematical game with it, but I mean, your point is right about climate change. We need to be, whatever the however the frequency of these things is changing, the state has responsibility to do a lot more to protect people and to help people evacuate. Like, we saw cops going around neighborhoods saying, all right, this is your last chance, get out. It costs, I didn't know this because I'm in North Dakota and I've never had to evacuate for something like this, about $1,200 to evacuate. Like, that's something the state should be assisting.
Yeah. Well, especially if they're going to be not acting whatsoever on climate change and denying it altogether. Florida is going to be especially vulnerable given how low many of the areas of the state are, and the islands are to sea level. So I'm hopeful that eventually they get DeSantis out of office and have somebody in there who's going to take this seriously, because this is not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Chloe Maxman and Canyon Woodward. Back, and we are joined now by Chloe Maxman, Maine State Senator, and political strategist Canyon Woodward, both of whom are the authors of Dirt Road Revival, How to Rebuild Rural Politics and Why Our Future Depends on It. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Yeah, of course. So, so Chloe, you were elected to the State Senate in Maine. You have a history of climate activism, which We began the show talking a bit about the devastation in Southwest Florida and how Hurricane Ian is more acutely felt given the effects of climate change. But talk a bit about your run for Maine State Senate and how you were able to get elected, because those experiences are really the backbone of your book here.
Yes. I grew up in a small town in rural Maine, and in 2018, I ran for the State House, and in 2020, I ran for the State Senate, and both times, Canyon was the brilliant campaign manager. We ran in districts that traditionally have been really tricky for Democrats to win, more rural and conservative districts, and our work has really been about how do we connect with folks who are different than us, and how do we really fight for progressive values in rural communities that are becoming more and more conservative.
And Canyon, what was, some of your background that brought you to working on a Maine State Senate campaign, and what made that unique in terms of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I also come from a very small town, western tip of North Carolina, conservative area, and got into organizing actually with Chloe in college. She founded the fossil fuel divestment movement at Harvard, and so we co-coordinated that, and so our background very much in the climate sphere, and but after years of organizing in that space, I think it was becoming super clear to us that the reason we weren't making the progress we needed legislatively was because of the people that we have in office, and the lack of folks really willing to go to bat on these issues. And so that's what led me to work on the Bernie campaign, both of us, and then for us to dive into the state level politics in Maine.
Well, so Chloe, you got elected, but correct me if I'm wrong, you did not shoot a gun in your political ad. I've been told, or what I see from Democratic strategists is that is a prerequisite for being a Democrat running in a rural area. I mean, I'm joking here a bit, but I guess just take us to how you ran, essentially, because you described your book as a tough love letter to the Democratic Party, but, you know, you ran on climate activism and a variety of other leftist planks without pandering to what I would say certain strategists think are caricatures of a rural voter.
Yeah, I think you framed that really well. You know, both Kenny and I are progressive people, and we grew up in these rural conservative. We have both of those identities, and I think we see so much how just the messaging and the strategy on the left just hasn't always landed well in rural communities. You know, I think most people mean well, and, you know, certainly there are so many Democrats on the ground who are fighting the good fight and are representing and are in office. And, you know, I think we found similar themes as so many other people, which is that a lot of rural folks really feel alienated by the Democratic Party. And sometimes the Democrats just don't take the time to go talk to folks who are different, you know, who are Republicans that have never been contacted by Democrats before. And so that's what we went and did. And I think, you know, some might think, oh, we had tricky conversations and no one voted for us. But we found the exact opposite, which is we had incredible conversations with people where we were starting to bridge these huge divides that are erupting in our society right now. And that work just became really, really important to us.
Yeah, you tell a story in your book about a man who you spoke with, and Medicaid expansion came up. And when you indicated your support for Medicaid expansion, he basically wanted you to screw off, but you continued that conversation. Can you describe that part of your book for us, and that interaction, I should say?
That was definitely one of the more life-changing conversations that I had with someone. You know, I'm honest to a fault sometimes. And so when he asked me if I believed in Medicaid expansion, I said yes. And he clearly disagreed. But I was just so taken aback at how things went south in 30 seconds that I asked him if he'd be willing just to take the time to talk with me about his position, even if he didn't end up voting for me. And, you know, he told me this really moving story about his life. And, you know, while I do believe in Medicaid expansion, I had a lot of respect for his story, and I would have never gotten to hear that if my initial reaction had been, okay, we have something really big that does not unite us, and so this conversation is over. That the power of listening and respecting what you hear and wanting to hear stories that are different from yours can go such a long way.
And Canyon, I mean, so much of what was central to your campaigns, focus was just door knocking. And I know that, you know, covering the Bernie campaign from a national perspective, or other leftist campaigns like the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez campaign, which I covered here in New York, that was so central to how there was success. And, I mean, how much of that was incredibly deliberate on your part? And would it even be more important in rural communities where there's such a kind of aversion to the Democratic Party that has probably ballooned based on, honestly, hard data over the past decade or so, or two decades, too?
Yeah, I mean, we go back just as recently as 2009, the partisan split in rural America was dead even. So it's not that long ago. And now it's a 16-point Republican advantage. And yeah, the door knocking is central. That's, you know, the movement the movement spheres where Chloe and I came from, and running a grassroots campaign that was really focused on going door to door and organizing volunteer teams and just going out and saying, hey, what's on your mind, as opposed to showing up with a clipboard and, you know, a script of here are our points on education and healthcare, et cetera. I think there's a really, really bad tendency in the Democratic Party, as you alluded to be like, oh, unless you're Joe Manchin, you know, you're not going to have a snowball's chance in hell of winning a rural district with a 16-point Republican advantage like what it was running in 2018. But the reality is, if you're willing to go and show up and listen to folks and build relationships and rebuild trust, folks are willing to vote for a Democrat. And I think that was proof to us that those dogmas within the Democratic Party need to be challenged and that we can still run and win in rural America.
So once you did get elected, Chloe, I know that one of your priorities was a rural Green New Deal. How did you sell that to voters? And I know it got cut into a little bit based on, you know, in the negotiation process, but you were still able to pass this. I feel like a lot of the national conversation around Green New Deal or climate justice politics are, well, these are just like East Coast liberals who want solar panels up the wazoo. But, you know, you were able to tailor it to your community.
Yeah, my first time running in 2018, I rarely heard folks mention the words climate change. And I really wanted the policy that I worked on to reflect and represent my community. But I did hear people talk about, you know, oh, the droughts in the summer make farming really hard, or I can't go ice fishing in the winter like I used to. You know, these ways that we're talking about climate impacts in a rural community. So I decided to sponsor an act to establish a Green New Deal for Maine to really draw attention to a different way of talking about climate change that's really rooted in a rural working class setting. We partnered with the unions. It was the first state Green New Deal bill to be endorsed by a state AFL-CIO affiliate. And that partnership was so inspirational to me, and just following the lead of the unions and their expertise and experience on the ground. It's just so important that the ways that we talk about climate change are really meant for the folks who we're talking to. There's not a uniform way to talk about this issue, and the policies for rural Maine and rural America are going to look really different for what suburban or urban places need. So I think, you know, for me, it was just a way of talking about this issue in a way that really represented my community.
And I'll say, too, I think, you know, this conversation is not, there's a characterization of the rural voter as basically a white person, but a big part of how the Democrats were able to flip Georgia in these latest two elections was turning out a lot of rural black voters in the state. And so a lot of this is just going to areas of the country and of states where Democrats need to make gains and actually campaigning there, because there's been mass divestment in rural areas in general by the National Democratic Party. Canyon, do you mind speaking to how that started to happen?
Gosh, I mean, I don't feel like I have the full inside look on that. I wish I knew, but I think you're totally right. Talking about Georgia, looking at Arizona, and what a huge role the indigenous vote had in flipping Arizona, Navajo Nation, and I think what Beto is doing in Texas is awesome, going out to every county there and organizing the Latino vote. And I think from the Democratic Party standpoint, it's just, yeah, I don't know how it started, but it definitely became ingrained of just like this idea that rural voters are ignorant, stupid, and voting against their own interests, and we're not even going to bother with trying to win them over. Instead, we're going to try and squeeze every vote we can out of, you know, Democratic strongholds. And you see that all across the party in the past decade. You know, we had the chair of the DNC in 2018 say, you can't knock doors in rural America, which you know, he apologized for, but that's, it was just really revealing of what the party mindset is towards rural America. And, you know, what we saw is you absolutely can and have to knock doors in rural America. That's what we should be leaning into really, really hard.
So can you talk about what's happened a bit more broadly over the past two decades, the massive amounts of loss in terms of rural county wins? Either of you can take this one, because Bill Clinton, you know, he was a lot more successful with rural counties, but, and then there was a big drop off with Obama, but Obama was a lot more successful with rural counties than Joe Biden, who there was a precipitous drop off there too, which, you know, again, speaks to something structural, clearly, in my opinion, as opposed to candidate based.
Yeah, there's, you know, part of what we dug into in the book is all of the many, many factors that have really contributed to Democrats losing a foothold in rural America. And I don't think that there's one single thing that we can point to. I think, you know, in general, the Democrats have a turnout focus on state level races. And so if you're trying to win a state level race, like governor, for example, and you need your Democrats to vote, you're really going to focus on the cities where all the Democrats, for a variety of reasons, have congregated. And that kind of leaves out all of the rural Democrats and all of the rural races from the calculus. And so as that has happened over the last many years, what we've seen is that Republican rural areas have just trended more and more to the right. The consequences of that are manyfold. You know, we're seeing them now as it impacts the presidency in many state level races in states where traditionally it's been a little bit more blue, but we're also seeing state legislatures as a whole tilt to the right. You know, Democrats lost almost 1,000 state legislative seats during Obama's presidency. And that's a huge thing. So in this day and age, when so much of the fight to protect our basic human rights are falling to state legislatures, it's more important than ever that we don't just focus on turning votes out in the city, but really going and supporting all of those amazing people who are pounding the pavement or pounding the dirt roads in their rural communities.
I mean, and to be completely cold-blooded about it too, rural voters have more power with their vote than other voters do due to the Electoral College and the way that our Senate is constructed. So it's, It from a national Democratic perspective, in terms of like just more Democratic seats, that also seems to be a smart strategy. And yet, this rural—I mean, you wrote about this. I'm not sure which one of your sections this was in, but the rural divestment really began in 2009, and these were due to decisions like, you know, Nancy Pelosi getting rid of the rural working group and Harry Reid not making a conscious choice for the Senate candidates to be a bit more focused elsewhere, right? Can you talk about what happened in advance of the 2010 midterms and what sustained from that?
Yeah, I think there's been a really active shifting away again back to the kind of failed calculus of thinking that demographic shifts were gonna hit a tipping point where you know, the cities and increasing the suburbs could carry Democrats to victory in a way that really has not panned out over the past decade. And I think that you know it's a problem that the leadership of the party just stays in place year after year with kind of the inertia of the same perspectives and the same sort of DC Beltway consultants that keep pushing these same failed strategies, even though we see how how much they set us back cycle after cycle. And I think until we are willing to buck some of this consultant establishment and mindset and demand more from our leadership, it's going to be hard to fully turn things around.
And Chloe, you know, I'm curious about your perspective on Sarah Gideon's loss to Susan Collins, because she was not the more progressive candidate in the Democratic primary, but the real what was spoken about in her favor was that she had deep pockets and she was able to fundraise against Susan Collins, and the poll numbers going into that race had her up. And so people thought this was maybe the safest possible flip, and it did not happen or come close to happening, honestly. So from your perspective in the state Senate and as someone who has run a race in that state, what did you see as the failures and maybe what the national press missed on that particular race?
Yeah, you know, I Sarah was the Speaker of the House during my first term in the legislature, and I think she's an amazing woman and an amazing leader, and I have a lot of respect for her. I think the campaign was just kind of flawed in some of the same ways that we're talking about here, which is just very, very, you know, deriving a lot of its strategy and its input from urban spaces and spaces that are outside of Maine. One of the things about Maine is that Mainers are very protective and prideful of our Maine identity. And so people could sense that and would read about all of the outside money flowing into Maine. And it really just contributed to the existing stereotypes of Democrats. Susan Collins is from rural Maine, and she's always had a very strong rural vote. And the Gideon campaign just didn't get out into rural communities, into all of the Republicans and independents who have historically voted for Susan Collins. There are some really great analysis after her loss that that really dug into this. But I think it's a good example of the trends that we're talking about. And you know, I think we all know how important it was for Democrats to defeat Susan Collins, and so again, just reiterating the importance of why we need to focus on rural voters so that we can win these critical seats.
Right. I mean, and I just hope that we learn a lesson from it, because as confident as we may be, and I'm way more confident, frankly, in the quality of the campaign that someone like John Fetterman is running, but we had some similar feelings about just at least the raw numbers going into 2020 and how Susan Collins could actually lose. And I'm just hopeful that there's some lessons learned about, you know, even if you have this this polling lead advantage, that the strategy matches it. And it seems like Fetterman's been able to do that. But for other candidates throughout the country, I'm hopeful about that. With that said, though, I think we're going to wrap up here. Chloe Maxman, Maine State Senator, and strategist Canyon Woodward, who worked on her campaign for State Senate. The book is called Dirt Road Revival: How to Rebuild Rural Politics and Why Our Future Depends on It. Thank you both so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Emma.
Thank you. All right, folks, with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be joined by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at NYU, who wrote a piece in The Atlantic about the return of fascism in Italy, is what it is entitled. We'll be right back. Back, and we are joined now by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, who wrote a piece on the far right's victory in the Atlantic, the far right's victory in Italy, I should say. The piece is in the Atlantic. It's called The Return of Fascism in Italy. Ruth, thanks so much for coming on today.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
So Georgia Maloney, let's just start there. Who is she? How did she get her political start? She's been described as neo-fascist, which is often a way to talk about this group of far right-wingers that are rising in Europe. But just talk a bit about her political rise and what she represents within the Italian political context.
Yeah, so she's there's lots of far-right leaders in power in the world right now, you know, Viktor Orban, Modi in India. But she is different because she comes directly out of this neo-fascist party, which was founded right after World War II when Mussolini, you know, died and fascism went up in ruins and the official fascist party was banned. So they founded this neo-fascist party to keep the ideals of fascism going. And this is where Maloney got her start. And I want to emphasize that she is a hardcore neo-fascist militant. She joined the party at 15. And by the 1990s, she was already the head of the youth organization, the youth wing, which is a big deal, national position. And she's remained in this party, you know, the whole time. And indeed, the Brothers of Italy, which is the party she's in now, it was formed in 2012 because there was no longer an autonomous extreme right party in Italy. And when they were selecting the logo of the party, you'll notice if you look at the logo, it's got a flame in there, a tricolor flame. And she's now attempting to say she's a conservative and she's just a patriot. And so you could think that the flame is the colors of the Italian flag. Well, that flame is the original logo of the neo-fascist party, and she insisted on keeping it in there. So she's very connected to fascism and its post-war history.
Yeah, and I mean, there are a lot of right-wingers trying to say that she's actually center-right here in the United States, yeah, reframing that context. But, you know, she's on record, as you say, she's been an activist since she was a teenager, age 17, I believe, speaking about how she has this regard for Mussolini openly. Yeah. And, I mean, talk a bit about the Brothers of Italy's kind of meteoric rise there, because as you say, if it's founded in 2012, I saw it was polling somewhere around 4% in 2018, yeah, and now it was polling at 23% earlier this month, as you write, but now it's going to be the largest component of this ruling conservative far-right coalition. I mean, how did that even come to happen?
Yeah, so there are many right-wing parties in Italy, which is in part a function of the weakness of the center-left. And so what we're dealing with now, this coalition, so she's in power with the League of Matteo Salvini, which is an openly racist, far-right, anti-immigrant party, and Silvio Berlusconi, who used to be prime minister, his Forza Italia party. And these are right-wing parties. And so, the history is that her party rose as these other parties descended in popularity. And Matteo Salvini is so extreme, and he's very incautious. He's a bit of a demagogue. And in 2018, which is when his party was doing better, he called for, quote, mass cleansings of immigrants. And he's been up on criminal charges for turning back immigrants' boats, causing human rights violations. So his party has descended and hers has risen. And they share many things. I mean, you can find video of her saying we shouldn't have any new mosques built in Italy. We should only have Italian spoken in Italy. She's a total conspiracy theorist. So she plays to fears about immigration as ruining white Christian civilization. And she's actually even to the right of Tucker Carlson, if that's possible, because it's not just, she doesn't just say that like demographic change is creating, you know, fewer white babies. She actually many times has tweeted and said there's a plot or a plan by George Soros and by the EU to actually flood Europe and Italy with mass immigration. And that's how you're going to get rid of white people. So this is who we're talking about.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned Tucker Carlson there. He seems to be, same with him and Steve Bannon, who she has a connection with as well. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that in a second. But this the elevating of leaders like Viktor Orban, Bolsonaro to another extent, or here Meloni in Italy, you know, their focus of like their political actors, these right-wing pundits, and they Bannon and Carlson, and they seem to try to make these far-right politics be transnational in the way that they speak about globalists, aka Jews, and how that relates to the EU. Can you talk about how interconnected this ideology is, and how frankly deliberate it seems?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. And since I'm a historian, I got to put the historical thing in, that fascism originally was always like, it had both things. It was hyper-nationalist, like Italy first, Germany first, but it was always transnational. And there were all these networks, it was called the Fascist International, trying to create this new order. And I have been seeing this coming about and tracking it, actually. And we see a far-right international, whether we want to call it Fascist International 2.0 or not, with a hub in Budapest with Orban, and there are all these exchanges. And Meloni is very central to these. And it's very interesting. She gave an interview to the Washington Post recently, and she said very matter-of-factly that she sees the GOP as part of this far-right international. And she said their battles are our battles. And so she's been to the National Prayer Breakfast. She's been to CPAC. And each victory, each person who's placed in power legitimates the movement as a transnational force and gives momentum to it. And so that's why Bannon is advisor to Bolsonaro. He's an advisor to Meloni, and he's advised her to tone down, you know, some of her rhetoric and try and be accepted as a conservative. And so there is this, it's quite underreported, the extent to which these links have spread throughout Europe and also the U.S. Part in it. And so for those who still struggle to accept that the GOP is a far-right authoritarian party, it's really interesting to hear Meloni just say in a normal tone, yeah, you know, the GOP is part of it.
I mean, right, exactly. We're buddies. And this being transnational and part of a larger European trend is also notable. I mean, she's spoken at Spain's extreme right Vox party, I guess some sort of convention, but they've praised her. Marine Le Pen is said this is a big deal. She's a fan of it. And we've seen what's happened in Sweden with this far right, you know, neo-Nazi connected movement. Mm-hmm. You know, how just to build off your point about this fascism 2.0 movement being transnational, how also is it connected within Europe and in relation to the EU?
So it's, you know, I think the grand design is ideologically, politically, is to, obviously, they're all very against the EU. Now you have cases where Orban, you know, I think Orban should be kicked out of the EU at this point. He shouldn't be getting EU funding, but he is. And so the EU has actually taken steps to be able to sanction people like Orban who are ruining democracies by reducing their funds. That's a very interesting new development. We'll see if they have to use that with Meloni or not. But there is this design to create this other, just like the new order of the original fascism, to create this alternate political and social order, which is, again, transnational and is opposed to Brussels, is opposed to the EU. Now, how they're going to do this is unclear, but if the given the power and the capital of America, if the GOP is able to take over in the next years and return someone to the White House, you can imagine how much more power and geopolitical clout this emerging 2.0, you know, far-right international would have.
And Meloni's often been compared to Marine Le Pen, but what is they both share the same gender and they're both extremist far right wingers. Can you talk about how, you know, I know Meloni has an anti-abortion stance in addition to her extreme anti-migrant anti-LGBTQ stance. So that is something that she shares as well with the far-right Republican Party in this country. But for those two in particular, you talk about it in your piece as gender washing, what they engage in. How does that look for both Maloney and Le Pen?
Yeah, so this concept, it's not mine, it's from political scientists who work on gender. And gender washing is when you have female politicians who use their, quote, softness. And if you look at, you know, both Le Pen and Maloney, they dress in understated clothing, a lot of pastels. They look very non-threatening, although Maloney is when she speaks, she's a bit of a demagogue. Le Pen's more careful. She's older. Le Pen is older. But they use this kind of female presence to both say they're going to be friends of women and women's rights. They're both into what Maloney calls the natural family, which is a man and a woman. So no same-sex unions, no same-sex adoption. And gender washing is also where this facade of softness is used to distract from the absolute brutality and racism and real-world violent consequences of their rhetoric, right? So, so if we look at what has happened in places where Brothers of Italy is already governing, like in the city of Verona, it was declared a pro-life city. And she has made it more difficult for women to access abortion rights and to exercise their rights of reproduction and to get, you know, morning after pill. And all this is very familiar in the U.S. context. But it's a really big deal in Italy because Italy is different. The Catholic Church is inside Italy as a sovereign entity. And abortion rights were very difficult to gain. In 1978, after a long battle by feminists, they got the right to abortion. And Maloney says she's not going to go after that. But there are ways today, just as you don't ban elections, you just game the system and use all kind of trickery. As you see the Verona example, there are ways to keep abortion a right, but make it very difficult to exercise that right.
And so do you think it's just very quickly a distinct possibility that this is more happens more on a national scale within Italy? A significant rollback in abortion rights. Okay.
Yeah, in a way that again will be settled. Now it's in Italy because the 1948 constitution was all about preventing a demagogic centralization of power like fascism. The regions and the local government have a huge amount of power. So we'll really have to see what happens. But what's been disturbing is that in this election, places like Tuscany that have historically been left-wing all the way back to the pre-World War I days, they are the center-left is losing ground. So those local governments may be changing in ways that are going to benefit Maloney's coalition.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at NYU, and you can read her piece in The Atlantic, The Return of Fascism in Italy. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
All right, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up the free hour of this program, and we are going to head into the fun half. I wish we had her for more time, but she's obviously incredibly busy as this Italy news is broke earlier this week. But I am curious to what the extent, like, a backlash towards neoliberal center-left politics is involved in, like, creating a fertile ground for this, perhaps a conversation for another day.
I think I saw something that Italy's economy has been basically in the pits for, like, a decade plus at this point. So, yeah.
Well, they were a victim of the austerity measures imposed on them, the Greece as well, but I would imagine that that's contributing to it. I just don't have the full knowledge base to, like, make a direct link, so perhaps for another day. But anyway, Matt, what is happening over on Left Reckoning?
Tuesday we had Darna Noor of the Boston Globe on to talk about Biden's climate policies, the IRA and such. And also, we had Cale Brookson for the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning, to get access to that, where we talked about MAGA communism had Cale assess that for us. Tonight, that we're going to do a live stream, cross stream with This Is Revolution. The left, I don't know what we're, I forgot what we branded it. This Is Reckoning or some whatever. That's tonight on the This Is Revolution and Left Reckoning streams.
And on ESPN today at 4 p.m., Bradley and I will be giving our picks for week four of the NFL. Bradley went 3-0, as I keep, you know, having nightmares about over the weekend. We'll see. I'm coming back with a vengeance. I really am. I'm going to get it right this time. And what we will also be talking about, too, is recently John Harbaugh and Odell Beckham Jr. had some comments about field turf and half of the stadiums in the NFL use field turf, and yet it increases the injury for players, particularly ACL tears and things of that nature, significantly. I want to dive deep into that and how that is a labor issue within the NFL, and it's really just greedy owners trying to cut costs by having field turf as opposed to, say, rolling Bermuda grass. We will touch on that today at 4 p.m. on ESVN OT on the Majority Report channel, so check us out there. And next week, by the way, we're going to have someone on to discuss a friend of mine who's we will reveal a later date to discuss the start of the NHL season and the Major League Baseball playoffs, too. So check us out, ESPN show, and rate us 5 stars, Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to youtube.com/ESPN show. All right. Do we have Matt?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we have Brandon. All right, we'll bring him in. Just a reminder, though, as Sam likes to say, hey, the show relies on your support. We can't do it without you. You can please become a member if you haven't already, and you can have access to the show without commercials. And the fun half, if you can't catch it live, majority.fm, sign up there, become a member, and support the show if you like us, because we are not like PragerU, where we can get $10 million or so of Republican donor money
fracking
to keep
money.
Us going. We are just doing it on our own, so we rely on you guys, and that's what makes this show possible. And just coffee.coop, fair trade tea and coffee, and chocolate. You can use the coupon code MAJORITY and get a little discount on that excellent coffee. But now we have, there we go, Brandon Sutton. Hello.
Yes, you do. Hello. Hello. Hello.
Well, good to see you, my friend. What is happening over on the discourse?
Well, on the discourse, we had to take a sabbatical because we were all hit very hard by the allergy season shift that happened last weekend. I don't know if anyone else was suddenly left.
Yep.
Incapacitated, I would say, to be like conservative, because I felt like I couldn't get like my wind for like 2 whole days the last weekend, but we were all incapacitated by allergies because we're soft. So yeah, you'll have to wait.
All right, soy
but
boys.
Today I'm enthusiastic because I've taken 3 different types of allergy medications as per my doctor's recommendation.
Ooh, so
allergies, I think
a bit of a cocktail.
I was talking to Dr. Eric Osgood. I think allergies, like my anecdotal experience is that allergies are worse post-COVID.
Hmm.
I was thinking you had said that too, and I would believe it. I feel like I got my first sinus infection post-COVID too, and it felt like it really just like, again, hit me hard.
Yep.
I'm just revealing all of my weaknesses. Most of them are, I guess, airway based.
No, I mean, I don't know about you, but at least for me, and I had COVID now like 7 weeks ago, my lung capacity still has not like gone back where it's supposed to be. Like my cardio is difficult for me. It was before too, but even more so now. Anyway. All right. We don't have Matt Binder, so we're just going to head into the fun half and then he will tell us what's happening on Doomed and Scam Economy. We will be taking your calls and reading your IMs and doing a bunch of fun clips we have today. I would say we are running the gamut, not gambit. Gamut, because I say that all the time, of right-wing influencers saying insane crap. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false. No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go tell
you. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.